You're listening to Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Did the hot, tumultuous summer of 2018 present a new level of climate change? Who would know if we have left normal behind? Bob Henson is kind of a cross between a meteorologist and a science writer. Among his five books is the popular college-level textbook Meteorology Today, written with Donald Ahrens. In his 24 years with University Corporation for Atmospheric Research, and that's a mouthful, and it publishes Atmospheric News, or Atmos News, it's really called, Bob was an editor and writer there. He had the inside track for science. Henson wrote the 2014 guidebook, The Thinking Person's Guide to Climate Change, and of course, he's an admitted storm chaser and blogger at the Weather Underground. When records are set, Bob Henson is keeping track. Bob, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hey, Alex. Great to be back with you again.
So, in last week's Radio EcoShock show, I reported global heat around the Northern Hemisphere this past summer. I said it was beyond normal, and maybe that summer was a unique event not seen before. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it was certainly an exceptional number of all-time record highs set at a number of prominent locations. You know, places like Seoul, South Korea, Glasgow, Scotland, Montreal, some cities in Southern California. So an unusually wide swath of places that had the hottest temperatures they've ever recorded. So I think it's the breadth of that heat that was really noteworthy. Now, of course, as usual, not every single spot was near records, and there were some cool spots, but I mean, we're going to have to see. The numbers are still several weeks out from knowing what the global average was for the Northern Hemisphere summer, which is, in the meteorological world, it's from June through August. So we don't know yet if it was the warmest summer on record globally or even in the Northern Hemisphere, but certainly one of the warmest. And certainly in terms of these pockets of extremely intense heat, and in some places, very persistent, especially in Scandinavia. I think that's what really stands out for me from this summer.
Yeah, Scandinavia, they had massive fires. They had to call in forest fighters from all over the world. 30-degree temperatures up in Lapland. We're talking in the Arctic Circle. They had a very hot summer. I found it very strange.
It absolutely was. I believe it was in Tromsø where they had the first night on record where the temperature stayed in the tropical range, say above 20, I think it was maybe above 26 degrees C. I don't remember precisely, but some climate scientists did a rather ironic photo of themselves sitting outside at dusk holding drinks and, you know, enjoying the first tropical night in that region. Of course, I'm sure it was a bittersweet enjoyment given that this is, you know, emblematic of what's happening to our global climate, but certainly the temperatures were not only extremely hot, but just recurrently and sustainedly hot for most of the summer.
Yeah, some of the people who live there don't even have clothes for that and certainly don't have air conditioners. Now, when it comes to Britain, in the British press, two UK scientists said the summer of 1976 was about as hot as this year, so nothing exceptional. But I have to note that in 1976, there were not heat waves in so many other parts of the world at the same time. It was kind of regional to the UK. What about earlier hot periods, Bob, like the 1930s or 40s? Have we seen anything comparable to this summer?
Well, it depends on what location you're looking at. In Britain, they have a record called the Central England Temperature Record, and what's really exceptional about that is it goes back to the 1600s. It's more than 340 years, so it's by far the longest continuous temperature record in the world, and it's a number of stations located in central England. So I believe this was in the top three or four hottest summers, certainly up there with 1976, and I believe, I want to say 1824, or somewhere in the 1820s. So that's a pretty rarefied group, you know, the hottest summer in many people's lifetimes in Britain. Now, in the United States, it wasn't the hottest summer for the country as a whole. For some areas, it certainly was. Southern California was, depending on where you were, was one of the very hottest summers we ever recorded. Parts of New England also had one of the very hottest summers on record. In the central part of the U.S., it was closer to average, not exceptionally hot in some parts of the plains. So kind of flanking the two parts of North America, I think, where Western North America and parts of the Northeast U.S., Southeast Canada were extremely hot. with a little bit of cool, relative mildness in between. So for the continent as a whole, nothing comparable to, say, the heat of 1936 that summer. It's kind of still the standard for record heat, but definitely one that we will be remembering.
It'd be interesting to compare the heat and humidity, if it's possible, to that 1936 event, because it certainly was stinking humid in the east as well. And I have to realize that listeners from the middle of America and onward east, they're not worried about wildfires or drought. They're bailing out basements after floods and extreme rainfall events. And, Bob, I thought flood season was in the spring, but now, is it any time?
Pretty much, yeah. And I think this is an underappreciated fact that many of the impacts related to climate change are going to be more related to water and the lack of it or having too much of it rather than temperature. You know, we can adapt in some ways as temperature creeps upward. There are many, many impacts, but also there are adaptation mechanisms, at least for humans. But when it comes to water, it's just very difficult to cope with either end of the water extreme. If you're simply not getting rain, you can't grow crops. There's many, many complications. You're getting too much rain, there's only so much you can do to keep the floods at bay. So we have had a lot of localized flooding, certainly the Mid-Atlantic. I think Baltimore had one of the wettest months in its history, I believe, either July or August was. Now, in September, the Midwest is getting hammered with a recurrent, repeated serious flooding. It's either too much or too little water, it seems, and I think the summer has been a good illustration of that.
Yeah, and Tropical Storm Gordon just struck Florida and the Gulf Coast last week, and it moved very slowly. It was dumping lots of rain. We've seen similar slow-motion storms, well, like Hurricane Harvey over Texas and others. Is that new, and what does it mean?
It's not new to have storms move slowly. However, there is a trend apparent, and a couple of researchers have recently looked closely at this. There is a trend toward more slow-moving storms, and we'll have to see how that manifests. Now, you have so much variability with hurricanes that it can be difficult to get the trend outside of the noise. So when we talk about a trend, you know, we're talking about maybe a mile or two an hour difference in forward motion, but any one hurricane could be moving at 30 miles an hour or 2 miles an hour. So, but nevertheless, there is this detectable trend toward slower moving storms, and that's a real concern because it's expected to increase, and the likelihood of getting slow moving hurricanes is expected to continue to go up. So, that was certainly the hallmark of Hurricane Harvey last year. It dumped large amounts of rain where it was raining, but it was simply the fact that it moved slowly that really made the difference and made it such a catastrophe.
We have the rare appearance of a typhoon in Hawaii with 4 feet of rain. That's noteworthy. But for me, the chain of typhoons striking Japan, including the last violent storm, seems exceptional, but maybe it's not. What do the records say about what's happening with Japan?
Well, Japan has had years with bad typhoons. They actually get, on average, 2 to 3 named storms a year. So they are there in the bowling alley, if you will. Now, most of those are typically either tropical storm strains or maybe Category 1 typhoons by the time they get to Japan. Now, the one that just struck, named Jebi, was actually a Category 2. So according to the Japan Meteorological Agency, it was the strongest landfall they've had in 25 years. And one illustration of its power, the airport at Kansai, which is near the port of Osaka, they actually fortified that airport with flood protection that was intended to keep any typhoons at bay and also be prepare them for rising sea levels. Well, that airport, about half of it flooded the other day as this typhoon came in. And the bridge that connects, the only land connection from that airport to the rest of the country, was damaged. So about 5,000 people were stuck at the airport for a few hours. So I think that's a great example of the infrastructure challenges we face in a climate that's evolving. We think we've built, and prepared ourselves for a certain event, and lo and behold, we get the storm surge, which in the case of the bay at the port of Osaka was the highest surge they've ever measured.
Wow. And then we have a report that a large city in Algeria recorded 51.3 degrees C or 123.4 degrees Fahrenheit in July. And if that's confirmed, that would be the highest reliable temperature ever recorded in Africa. And that's saying something. Have you heard anything more on that?
No, I haven't. I haven't been following that one closely. Certainly Death Valley was a record setter this year. They had the hottest single month in July, not only for the United States, but for the world as a whole. If you look at the average temperature, averaging both the highs and the lows for the whole month.
The highest average temperature for the whole world was set this summer.
Yep. If you take an entire month and you essentially take the highs and the lows and munch them together and find out what is the single average for that whole month, 24/7 average, I believe it was 107 or 108 Fahrenheit. Mind you, that's including highs and lows.
Wow.
So a pretty extreme climate, to say the least. And that just nudged them above the previous record, which was also set in Death Valley. So that's very significant locally, but also, you know, very evocative globally of a warming climate.
Kind of a flag, yes. And when nights don't cool down, I know that's very dangerous for human health. And NPR reported that on June 26th in Kiryat Oman, the low temperature of nearly 109 degrees Fahrenheit was the highest ever recorded in the world. I don't know. It seems like nighttime lows might be as important to watch as the daytime highs.
Certainly, in terms of heat wave impacts, nighttime lows are hugely important. You know, it can be pretty easy to get through one hot day if you have access to shade and so forth, even if you don't have air conditioning at home. But at night, your body is counting on that break from the heat. And if the temperatures run really high for multiple nights, then an un-air-conditioned house just won't have a chance to cool down. And the interior temperatures can get very high, and it's just much harder for a body to take multiple days like that. So certainly the added moisture in the atmosphere is one factor. Interestingly, in places that grow a lot of corn, such as Iowa and Illinois, there's been a very marked trend in the last couple of decades as this corn growing has intensified and there's more corn per acre. That corn puts out a lot of moisture from the ground. So what ends up happening is the summer days are actually getting slightly cooler, but the summer nights are getting quite a bit warmer. So you have a constricted temperature range, but a little higher than the temperature range was before. So you may not have the scorching summer days in that neck of the woods, but the nights are getting more and more insufferable.
What other weather events or records are on your mind or in your Weather Underground blog?
Well, it's hurricane season, so obviously we're dealing with that. It was looking like a fairly quiet Atlantic season, but things have certainly gotten busy here in the first part of September. So that looks like that may continue for a few more days. I'm going to be watching to see what happens with El Nino. There is considered to be a pretty good chance we're going to have El Nino this winter, but it's not for sure yet. It hasn't quite come together as quickly as we thought it might, but if we do get a move toward El Nino, I think that will push us potentially toward another global record high. You know, we set global records in 2014, 15, and 16, and 2017 was right behind those three. So when we have an El Nino going on, that's actually spreading warm water across the tropical Pacific, and that warmth percolates from the atmosphere to the air. So when we have global records these days, it's almost always during an El Nino because the warming climate kind of expresses itself in those records during El Nino. So if we do get an El Nino, I would predict that we have a good chance of yet another global record in 2018, if not 2017.
I wonder, Bob, what it would take to say we're in the Anthropocene weather period.
Oh, boy, that's a good question. You know, nobody really knows. It's difficult to pin down what the flavor of the Anthropocene will be like, in part because it's a moving target, you know. Or when you have, you know, the greenhouse gas forcing that is leading to climate change getting more and more intense over time, it takes time for that push toward a warmer climate to kind of filter through the whole system, through the oceans and so forth. So we actually have warming that's tucked away in the oceans that has yet to be expressed in the atmosphere. In other words, even if we turned off every engine and didn't burn a drop of fossil fuel, we still have maybe another degree Fahrenheit of atmospheric warming on the way. So because of all that, you know, I don't think we're going to get to a new normal. And I've heard several people actually saying new normal is not really the optimal phrase anymore. It's sort of like a new shifting norm that we won't be able to count on because it's going to be continually moving in that warmer direction and towards more hydrologic extremes. Now most weather will still look familiar. You know, most days will still be like days we've experienced in the past, but the extremes will be getting a little more extreme in many places at many times.
Well, talking about how that's all going to develop, there are groups of scientists who worry about abrupt climate change, something unmanageable, developing over just a few decades or even less. And I know in the U.S., the National Research Council had a committee on abrupt climate change, and the Pentagon has considered the implications of a shift, but that's a remote possibility for them. What do you think?
Well, you know, to be honest, I feel like I have my hands full, certainly, thinking about the more confident changes, you know, the already definite trend toward extreme rainfall getting more extreme, general global temperatures rising, potential for heat waves get worse. All those things kind of are not reliant on an abrupt change. Those are simply kind of baked into the way climate change is going to work as the climate warms. So I personally tend to focus more on those, if only because they're a little more confident. When you get to lower probability events, those can be, of course, much higher impact, but there's a lot more uncertainty around them. So I think certainly in terms of public planning, it becomes a harder sell. I mean, just to give you an example, when you have a hurricane watch issued by the U.S. National Weather Service or the cone of uncertainty around a hurricane, that's not actually the outer bounds. It's more like the two-thirds probability range. So whenever you see that watch or that cone, there's a 1 in 3 chance the hurricane will go outside of it. So we don't really plan for those 1 in 3 chances because you can't always be planning for the very low probability things. So I sort of think of it in terms of a spectrum. Like we put most of our energy in preparing for the impacts we know are most confident from climate change while keeping an eye on the outer ones like abrupt climate change. And I'm certainly not at all discounting the possibility of abrupt climate change. I think it's a really serious concern. But I do think there's also non-abrupt ones that are maybe even a little less sexy but more certain. You know, nuisance flooding is a great example of that. You know, the floods that are now striking places like South Florida every single autumn with the king tides, those are just going to continue to get worse and worse. And there was a major study out on that this year. Places that now get a flood like that maybe 3 or 4 times a year could get them 180 times a year within our lifetimes, you know, in the next several decades. So that's something that's not reliant on an abrupt climate change. That's simply a prediction.
Especially with the rising seas. I mean, if something happens 180 days a year, it's time to realize your place is going under and time to move.
Yeah, and we're going to have, I think, an economic, you know, reverberation that will be striking and profound along coastlines, especially low-lying coastlines, say, in the southeast U.S., because sooner or later it's going to catch up with people that certain places near the coast are just not going to be livable. And the question is, who will get out first? And once people start selling properties, you can get a chain reaction. So I think some neighborhoods are people are really going to get hurt and not be able to predict exactly the timing of those shifts. So I think that's a real economic challenge, not only for those localities, but for states and regions as well.
Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with meteorologist and science journalist Bob Henson. You can join his 5,000 Twitter followers at bhensonweather.com. Today we're talking about extreme weather and climate change in the summer of 2018. It's been wildly hot in the Arctic, as you know, Bob. Glaciers are losing billions of tons of water mass, and the summer sea ice is low again. It's not necessarily a record, but it's low, and it's very thin. There's hardly any old ice. Do you think that the extreme changes in the Arctic already contribute to disturbed weather further south?
I have a strong sense that they are. It's a really interesting area of research, and I think work on that has been led by Jennifer Francis at Rutgers, and Judah Cohen at Atmospheric Environment Research. And your listeners have probably heard their names, Cohen and Francis. They've done quite a few papers on the connection between changes in the Arctic and changes in mid-latitude weather. And some of those have been a little counterintuitive, tendency toward perhaps more intense winter storms in the northeast when sea ice is low. And those kinds of connections that aren't necessarily expected that may be there, I think, are really important to study. Anyway, that work continues, and I think it's slowly gaining more widespread attention. It has been considered sort of a niche area for a few years, but I think more people are starting to pay attention to it now. And certainly as the Arctic continues to melt and we have longer and longer periods of more and more open water, I don't see how it can't affect the region at least. And its effects on the jet stream are more subtle, but really interesting. for example, summertime weather patterns slowing down and getting stuck. There was an important paper led by Michael Mann of Penn State on that just in the past year or so. So, yeah, I do think that the Arctic sea ice loss is important with respect to mid-latitude climate. I think it's still early days in terms of research in that area, but I think we will learn a lot about it in the next few years.
And, of course, I'm impressed by the wildfires because one came so close to my house this summer and I was in the smoke for so long. But looking at a global wildfire map, they were all across the Northern Hemisphere. It was just amazing. I've never seen anything like it. And I started to wonder, well, maybe these wildfires could release enough carbon and aerosol particles to actually change the climate, whether it's in the short term or the long term. Have you been seeing anything on that in the science writing that you look at?
I cannot say that I have. Certainly there are huge volumes of aerosols put out by fires. And, you know, I don't know where those stand in terms of magnitude with respect to all the other forcing factors. We do know that there were massive wildfires in North America in the late 1800s, as, you know, folks were moving into these forested areas and establishing settlements and basically just tearing down the forests, and these massive fires would sweep across the region and even into the early 1900s. So it would be interesting, if possible, to go back and look at those and see how those affected local and regional and even hemispheric climate. But certainly the fires of today are catastrophic because they're affecting places in many places where people have moved in the last several decades. You know, there's been a move toward what we call the urban wildland interface, where people want to live near a city but also be in beautiful forested country. Well, unfortunately, wildfires head right to those areas, just like any other part of the forest. So I think the impacts on people have really grown intense, and certainly the intensity of the burning of the fires has been an issue in many places because of the more intense drying of some of the forests and in the nearby landscape. You can get a couple degrees of cooling if you're in the ash cloud or really thick smoke from a fire. And they actually kept some places from setting record highs this summer that otherwise might have.
Interesting. Might throw the records off. I was in a very cold day one day in kind of a fire smog. I want to move on to how the media treats this extreme weather we've seen and climate change. A recent report by the nonprofit group Public Citizen found that during the recent heat wave, in 90% of the articles about that heat wave, the largest 50 U.S. newspapers did not mention climate change at all. Another group, Media Matters, looked at coverage by the American major TV networks. And in that critical two-week period from late June to early July, they found only one segment out of 127 about the heat, only one mentioned climate change at all. So that real story is, it's missing in action, don't you think?
I do think it is often missing in action. It can be difficult to always bring in climate change in a sort of stereotyped way, and I would hate to see it just become a rote sentence that is the same in every single article, because then I think readers would tend to gloss over. There is, you know, some social science research has shown that if you repeat a message over and over, it actually does tend to sink in. But personally, I try to vary the message, you know, vary the tempo. I think sometimes it's nice to bring in readers who may just turn the page the moment they see the words climate change. So I like to engage some of those readers and then get them used to the blog. And then when they see a climate change article, maybe they'll trust me enough to pay attention, I hope. So, yeah, I think it is an issue. And think about, for example, reports on health conditions and how often those are tied back to causes. And they aren't always. And maybe those should be as well. Maybe every story on lung cancer should mention that smoking is the primary cause. And I think a lot of times they do. And I think we might notice if there are many stories on lung cancer and not a single one mentioned smoking, we would be like, wait a minute, that ought to be in here.
Yeah, for sure. Well, along the same lines, a new poll in Britain shows that after the heat wave, 72% of British adults are very or fairly concerned about climate change. The numbers always go up after heat waves or superstorms. People, it seems, have to experience it for themselves. But, Bob, can we really wait until we fry to change away from fossil fuels?
Well, this is makes me think of if you have a wildfire beating down on you, or let's say you're being told that there could be a wildfire in the next 2 days or a hurricane in a week, don't you think it's human tendency to wait till the last minute? You know, we always want to wait until we know we have to do something. And so I think that's the rub. And I agree with you. I don't think it's wise to wait until the last minute. We really should be addressing climate change sooner rather than later. And as you know, that's got to involve both adapting and mitigating. In other words, dealing with the changes that we already have and that are coming, that we're sure of, and trying to keep those future changes to a minimum, which is the mitigation piece of it. And for so long, there was a battle between those two, and people said we can only do one or the other. And, of course, I really think we have to do both and ramp up those efforts as well.
Your job and my radio show will have lots to do, probably more than we can even report. How do you feel about that, and do you think weather watchers will be able to cope?
It's a struggle at times, to be honest. I had periods where I felt quite discouraged, and I'm keenly interested in both weather and climate. I always have been, and it's a passion of mine to write about them and a joy. But the topic can be a downer. There's no getting around that. And, I especially hate to see us stepping backward, and I hate to see policies where we allow more emissions rather than less, and especially if those are kind of penny-wise and pound-foolish. So moving in that direction have discouraged me some in the last year or two. So I'm hoping that we turn the tide on those, and we just got to reduce fossil fuel emissions. That's the root cause of climate change, and there are many ways to do that and many strategies, and we have to keep our eyes on that prize. And I should say also that, in particular, coal emissions have an incredible side benefit. By reducing those coal emissions, there are huge benefits to public health. And because coal emissions have such profound impact on respiratory systems and so forth, I think by reducing fossil fuels, we'll have major health benefits. And that should be additional motivation, as if we needed any more motivation.
Yeah, we can live longer. That's a bonus. Now, something that you just mentioned earlier, which is people getting too overdriven about a particular subject, getting worn out about it, and we could have so many climate-driven disasters, so many bad weather incidents, that we just take it for granted as another part of life, as the new normal. What if we get bored watching weather porn on TV and just tune it out?
Oh, that can happen. I think I know folks that are already there, and I feel that way sometimes myself. I think we just have to stay sensitized, and I think a sense of proportion is helpful. You know, there's hurricanes every year. There are tornadoes every year. In a sense, it's normal to have a few records here and there. What would be strange is if every single day of every month the temperature hit the average high and the average low. I actually did a micro study for my textbook, and it took 1 month to see how often in that month the high and the low were exactly on average, and I think it was maybe one day in that month. So it's normal to have variations in weather and climate. What's not normal is to have the variations relentlessly going toward a hotter climate and relentlessly going toward extreme rains and snows getting more extreme. So those are the signals that, mixed in with all this natural variability, we have climate change. So when we cover like specific weather and climate events, I think it's important to link those to climate change where appropriate, and the stronger the link, the more to emphasize it. But if we hit every single event with the same hammer, then I think people will kind of get numb to it. So I think it is important to be proportionate.
And the other thing is that I remember growing up as a kid, summer was the good weather. That was the time to look forward to. We had maybe thunderstorms, but I didn't worry about wildfires. I never heard about wildfires, and I lived in Canada. And the kind of heat waves, if it got hot for a couple of days in August, that was a big deal. But now it's like constant. It starts in early June in Toronto, Canada, and runs right up into September, where people are just sweating their way through the summer. It's not the good times we used to look forward to.
Yeah, but I have to say, it's, for one thing, the margins of seasons. It's not just that it gets hotter in the middle of, say, summer, but that the edges of a certain level of heat are pushing in either direction. So the heat starts sooner and ends later in the year. So that taps into things like school years kicking in, say, August or September, when it's still really hot. You might have to go get air conditioners for an entire school system where it wasn't once necessary. And the middle of the summer, which was once pleasant, is now more often intolerable, depending on your level of heat tolerance. So, and those are real-life feelings. And I think in particular, I think about the Western U.S. and Western Canada. You know, when I started dealing with climate change quite a bit after I joined NCAR in 1989, at that point, the climate models were pretty crude. And the message was generally continents will get hotter faster than oceans. So when you look at a very crude map of North America, there would be a little hot blob right in the middle of the continent. Well, now we know and we're seeing that the heat is manifesting a little bit more towards, say, western U.S., western Canada, and then also toward northeast U.S. and parts of eastern Canada. And it's not heating up quite as much as we thought it would, say, in the Midwest and Great Plains. And to me, that's fascinating. I think it's partly because the models 30 years ago just weren't precise enough to show us that. But also effects like I talked about, agriculture, which has become extremely intense in the Midwest, is a different form of human altering of the ecosystem. So you've got kind of climate change trying to warm the climate in that region through fossil fuels, but increased agriculture kind of blunting the temperature range. And kind of what is a real climate or what is natural weather anymore? We really don't know. It's kind of like the metaphor of the garden. That once it's tended, it's never going to be a wild place again, and we just have to deal with that.
I totally agree with you. We've kind of cycled back to where we began, that we don't know what normal is for sure. We're going to have to leave it there, Bob. We've been talking with meteorologist, journalist, and storm guy Bob Henson, and I think of his blogs at the Weather Underground, but Bob publishes all over the place and in mainstream publications. His textbook teaches college kids, and his insight teaches all of us. You can follow B. Henson Weather on Twitter and check out Bob's blog at www.wonderground.com. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Oh, well, thank you, Alex. My pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. That's it for this week. My thanks to supporters and everyone who dares to tune into these unpleasant truths. Don't forget to follow up with links and more on my weekly show blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.org. I'm Alex. May we all see less worse days ahead.